John Batts with Ron White, the author of On Great Fields, The Life and Unlikely Heroism of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. The heroism happened, those battles in the Civil War, but this is a way of looking at the recovery of America from the Civil War as best it can. The governorship is not enough. Chamberlain is now asked to come back to Bowdoin College as the president. And I note that this is significant only because, as a Union hero, you would expect him not to go back to scholarship. He can live on other opportunities in the government. It's all dominated by Republicans. Let's go to the visit of his hero, Ulysses Grant. What's this, 1871? Why does Grant come to Maine?
Grant comes to Maine to help promote a new international railroad. And as he comes and stops in Brunswick, where Bowdoin College is located, he invites Chamberlain to go with him to the great celebration in Bangor. When the Civil War had ended and Chamberlain learned that Grant on a tour was in Portland, he invited him to come to Bowdoin, and Bowdoin College gave to Grant an honorary degree. So these two men's lives kind of intersect each other. They respected each other. At Petersburg, when Chamberlain was thought to be dead, Grant wanted to promote him on the spot, quote unquote, on the spot, so that his rank and his renown would be for his family, even in his death. They knew each other and respected each other.
Now, Grant is the savior of the Union. That was not controversial in 1865. They drafted him to be president of the United States because of the tangle with Andrew Johnson. He's not a natural politician. He's not a politician at all.
No.
And Chamberlain's not a politician, so we have two non-politicians being hero-worshipped. But Chamberlain's about to go on to Bowdoin College as president, not as a ceremonial post. My note here says $2,600 a year, which is not a whole lot of money. Even then, it was not a whole lot of money. But he has, as he had progressive ideas as a governor, he has them as an educator, too. He wants to grow the college. How, Ron?
Well, he says this in his inaugural address, which must have been quite something for those who were in the audience. He said, the times had shot past the college. She stood still while the world at full flood and flushed with new life swept on. The college had touched bottom. So he asked two questions, how to rise again and how to begin. He says, well, we might confine our efforts chiefly to holding our own, strengthening the things that remain, and feel our way by cautious and imperceptible degrees. The second answer, which he wanted to adopt, was we might accept at once the challenge of our time, advance boldly to the key points of the position, and be forced enough to hold it at all hazards. One of the ways he wanted to do this was to introduce science. Right. This is the intellectual current of the last third of the 19th century. The alumni wanted change, but they weren't too sure how much change they really wanted.
He wanted science. He wanted a medical school. He wanted women. Yes. He wanted co-education.
Yes.
Everything was disruptive to the fathers of the school.
Yes.
And he kept on, and he was at odds with them, and he kept trying to resign, and they wouldn't let him resign.
He tried to resign twice, and each time they refused to accept his resignation.
And the education at Bowdoin College also was very much influenced by Congregationalism versus the Unitarians. How so?
Well, the college, although not officially founded by the Congregational Church, most colleges in the early 19th century were founded by Protestant denominations. They really felt they owned the college. But yet Unitarianism, which began in Boston, now begins to make inroads into Maine. And although Chamberlain remains quite traditional in his own Christian belief, he also recognized that the college needed to be open, not simply to Baptists and Methodists, but also to Unitarians who were now coming to Maine.
The contest, however, turns on a family affair as well. Fanny is attracted to the Unitarian Church. Is she a member that she hides from him?
Well, this was quite a problem. She decided not to join her stepfather's church. And although this must have been difficult for him, this says something about his inclusive vision. He allowed, this was all right with him. Ultimately, his daughter, Grace, would not join the church either. This was very difficult for him, but he had to accept the fact that people had their own choices in terms of religion.
Detail about him at home as well. There's tension in the marriage. We've talked about that. There's tension with what he wants to do next as we go forward. He's making speeches the whole time, though, correct? I mean, even as president and overworked as he is, he accepts opportunities to speak. Is his speaking getting better? Is he growing his arsenal of battles?
Yes, I suggest that if you were to ask him what was his most satisfactory experiences, it wouldn't be governor of Maine, it wouldn't be president of Bowdoin College, it would be as a speaker. He was far beyond the usual Union veteran because he could use the Bible, quote Dante and Goethe, have allusions from Greece and Rome, and people just found him the most eloquent speaker in the war, in the years after the war.
He eventually does find a way forward. However, we're coming to a part of his life that involves politics and war fighting and risk. Remember, he's wounded. He's badly wounded, and he doesn't have confidence in his own health. And sometimes he has to spend a great deal of time in bed. But when we come back, the confrontation in Augusta, Maine, between armed rebellion and the Republican and Democratic and Greenbacks parties. The book is On Great Fields. Ron White is the author.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.